Now, the next subheading in this chapter is Essentials of Successful Characterization, Ideal Tragic Hero, Hamartia, Hamartia. Idealization of Reality. According to Aristotle, tragedy idealizes, imitates men as better, and comedy caricatures, that is, shows man as worse or lower than they actually are. Tragedy idealizes and brings out the hidden possibilities embedded in men. The characters in a tragedy are real men and women, but they are of the better sort, and further by a judicious process of selection and elimination, the reality is heightened and the good in them is made more prominent and impressive. A skillful painter paints from reality, but the object painted is made to look more beautiful than the original. It is still reality, but reality idealized. In the same way, the poet has reality as his basis. He depicts real men and women, but he idealizes reality and so represents men finer and nobler than they actually are. Next subheading in this subunit is Four Essentials of Characterization. In chapter 15th of the Poetics, Aristotle deals with the art of characterization on an extended scale. He lists four essentials of successful characterization. The first one is, the characters must be good. The character is good if his words and actions reveal that his purpose is good. In ancient Greek, women were considered as inferior beings, as slaves, as worthless. But Aristotle says that when introduced in a tragedy, even women and slaves must be shown to have some good in them. Entirely wicked characters, even when assigned minor roles, are unfit for tragedy. Wickedness may be introduced only when required by the necessities of the plot. Wanton or willful introduction of wickedness must be avoided, and when introduced, even wicked characters must be made good in some respects. Wickedness must be mixed with some good, as in actual life. In other words, Aristotle favors complex characters. Just as a successful painter makes his portrait more beautiful than the original and still retains the likeness to the original, in the same way, the poet must represent his characters better and more dignified and must still preserve the likeness of the original. But what does Aristotle mean by good? The word has variously been interpreted by various critics. While some critics have interpreted the word in the sense of general moral quality revealed in action, more specifically in the choices the character makes, F.L. Lucas emphatically declares that from the context, it becomes clear that good means fine or noble. The characters should be as fine as the plot permits. Humphrey House goes to the root of the matter and says that the word good has been used here in the Greek sense and not in the Christian sense. In the Greek sense, the word goodness implies a number of virtues such as courage, magnificence, temperature, liberality, friendliness, etc. In any case, a negative cloistered virtue is not meant, but a jealous and energetic goodness. Aristotle's good man is not good unless he is desiring specific positive good ends and working towards its attainment. Goodness, according to Greek conception, lay not in endurance or humility, but in strength and intensity of character, in the greatness of soul, even in physical strength, which enables a man to achieve his ends. The characters need not be paragons of virtue in the Christian sense, but they must have grandeur, or they may be brave or upright or determined. Above all, they must not be weak, for weakness is the hardest to justify on the stage. Secondly, the characters must be appropriate. That is to say that they must be true to type or status. For example, a woman must be shown as womanly and not manly. A slave must be given a character which is appropriate to his status. Manliness would not be appropriate in a woman, and dignity and nobility in a slave. If the characters are taken from some non-myth or story, say the story of King Oedipus, then they must be true to tradition. They must behave as King Oedipus is traditionally supposed to have behaved. In this respect, Aristotle had the practice of Greek dramatists in mind, who chose their tragic themes from history, myth, and other traditional sources. Aristotle's criterion of appropriateness has come in for a good deal of criticism. It is said that Aristotle lays down that the characters should be true to type, that they must have the characteristics peculiar to their age, profession, sex, or social rank and status. They be true and appropriate representatives of the class or group to which they belong. However, this doesn't mean that they should be mere types and not individuals. They must have generic or typical qualities, but they can also be and must be individualized at the same time. Their individuality is guaranteed by the fact that tragedy represents not men, but men in action. The actions of even the personages of the same type are bound to differ from situation to situation. It is action which is bound to reveal their individuality. The choice which they make in a critical situation is bound to reveal their individual characters. Aristotle's insistence on appropriateness is a sure safeguard against the oddity and eccentricity that probing into the depths, which is a basic weakness in the characterization of many a modern novel, and which comes in the way of the development of plot. The third essential of successful characterization is that characters must have likeliness, that is, they must be like ourselves or true to life. In other words, they must have the virtues and weaknesses, joys and sorrows, loves and hatreds, likes and dislikes of average humanity. Such likeliness is essential, for we can feel pity only for one who is like ourselves, and only his most misfortunes can make us fear for ourselves. This in itself rules out perfectly good or utterly wicked and depraved characters. Such characters will not be like us. They will be unreal and unconvincing. The characters must be of an intermediate sort, mixtures of good and evil, virtues and weaknesses like us. Fourthly, the characters must be consistent. They must be true to their natures, and their actions must be in character. Thus, a rash, impulsive person should act rashly and impulsively throughout. There should be no sudden changes in character. If the dramatist has to represent an inconsistent person, then he must be consistently inconsistent. Aristotle emphasizes the point further by saying that the actions of a character must be the necessary and probable outcome of his nature. He should act as we may logically expect a man of his nature to act under the given circumstances. Just as the incidents must be casually connected with each other, so also the various actions of a character must be necessarily and probable consequence of his character and the situation in which he is placed. They must be logically interlinked with his earlier actions and must not contradict an impression produced earlier. The next subheading is the ideal tragic hero. Having examined the art of characterization in general, Aristotle proceeds to examine the qualities which the ideal tragic hero must have. No passage in the Poetics, with the exception of the catharsis phrase, has attracted so much critical attention as his ideal of the tragic hero. His qualities. The function of a tragedy is to arouse the emotions of pity and fear, and Aristotle deduces the qualities of his hero from this function. He should be good, but not too good or perfect, for the fall of perfectly good man from happiness into misery would be odious and repellent. His fall will not arouse pity, for he is not like us, and his undeserved fall would only shock and disgust. Similarly, the spectacle of an utterly wicked person passing from happiness to misery may satisfy our moral sense, but is lacking in the proper tragic qualities. Such a person is not like us, and his fall is felt to be well deserved and in accordance with the requirement of justice. It excites neither pity nor fear. Thus, according to Aristotle, perfectly good as well as utterly wicked persons are not suitable to be heroes of tragedies. However, Elizabethan tragedy has demonstrated that, given the necessary skill and art, even villains like Macbeth can serve as proper tragic heroes, and their fall can arouse the specific tragic emotions. There is no doubt that there is something terrible and sublime in mere willpower working its evil way, dominating its surroundings with a superhuman energy. It's the statement of Butcher, Butcher. The wreck of such power excites in us a certain tragic sympathy. We experience a sense of loss and regret over the waste or misuse of gifts so splendid. Similarly, according to Aristotelian canon, a saint, a character perfectly good, would be unsuitable as a tragic hero. He is on the side of the moral order and not opposed to it, and hence his fall shocks and repels. Moreover, his martyrdom, 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 is a spiritual victory, and the sense of moral triumph drowns the feeling of pity for his physical suffering. The saint is self-effacing, self-effacing. The saint is self-effacing and unselfish, and so he tends to be passive and inactive. Drama, on the other hand, requires for its effectiveness a militant and combative hero. However, in quite recent times, both Bernard Shaw and T.S. Eliot have achieved outstanding success with saints as their tragic heroes. In this connection, it would be pertinent to remember first that Aristotle's conclusions are based on the Greek drama with which he was familiar, and secondly, that he is laying down the qualifications of an ideal tragic hero. He is here discussing what is the very best and not what is good. On the whole, his views are justified, for it requires the genius of a Shakespeare to arouse sympathy for an utter villain, and saints or successful tragic heroes have been extremely rare. Having rejected perfection as well as utter depravity, depravity, having rejected perfection as well as utter depravity and villainy, Aristotle points out that ideal tragic hero must be an intermediate kind of person, a man not preeminently virtuous and just, whose misfortune, however, is brought upon him not by vice or depravity, but by some error of judgment. The ideal tragic hero is a man who stands midway between the two extremes. He is not eminently good or just, though he inclines to the side of goodness. He is like us, but as Bucer points out, raised above the ordinary level by a deeper vein of feeling or heightened powers of intellect or will. He is idealized, but still he has so much of common humanity as to enlist our interest and sympathy. Hamartia. The tragic hero is not depraved or vicious, but he is also not perfect, and his misfortune is brought upon him by some fault of his own. The Greek word used here is hamartia. The root meaning of hamartia is missing the mark. He falls not because of the act of some outside agency or vice or depravity, but because of hamartia or miscalculation on his part. Hamartia is not a moral failing, and hence it is unfortunate that it has been translated rather loosely as tragic flaw, as has been done by Bradley. Aristotle himself distinguishes hamartia from moral failing and makes it quite clear that he means by it some error of judgment. He writes that the cause of hero's fall must lie not in depravity, but in some error or hamartia on his part. Bucer, Bywater, and Rostangi all agree that hamartia is not a moral state, but an error of judgment which a man makes or commits. However, as Humphrey House tells us, Aristotle doesn't assert or deny anything about the connection of hamartia with moral feelings in the hero. It may be accompanied by moral imperfection, but it is not itself a moral imperfection, and in the purest tragic situation, the suffering hero is not morally to blame. Thus, hamartia is an error or miscalculation, but the error may arise from any of three ways. It may arise from ignorance of some material fact or circumstance, or secondly, it may be an error arising from hasty or careless view of the special case, or thirdly, it may be an error voluntary but not deliberate, as in the case of acts committed in anger or passion. Els and Martin Ostwald, both critics of eminence, interpret hamartia actively and say that the hero has a tendency to err, created by the lack of knowledge, and he may commit a series of errors. They further say that the tendency to err characterizes the hero from beginning, and that at the crisis of the play it is complemented by the recognition scene, which is a sudden change from ignorance to knowledge. As a matter of fact, hamartia is a word which admits of various shades of meaning, and hence it has been differently interpreted by various critics. However, all serious modern Aristotelian scholarship is agreed that hamartia is not moral imperfection, though it may be allied with moral faults. That is, it is an error of judgment, whether arising from ignorance of some material circumstance or from rashness and impulsiveness of temper or from some passion. It may even be character trait, for the hero may have a tendency to commit errors of judgment and may commit not one but a series of errors. This last conclusion is borne out by the play Oedipus Tyrannus, to which Aristotle refers again and again, and which may be taken to be his ideal. In this play, the life of hero is a chain of errors, the most fatal of all being his marriage with his mother. If King Oedipus is Aristotle's ideal hero, we can say with Bucer that his conception of hamartia includes all the three meaning mentioned above, which in English cannot be covered by a single term. Hamartia is an error or a series of errors, whether morally culpable or not, committed by an otherwise noble person, and these errors derived him to his doom. The tragic irony lies in the fact that hero may err innocently, unknowingly, without any evil intention at all, yet he is doomed no less than those who are depraved and sin consciously. He has hamartia, he submits error or errors, and as a result of his very virtues hurry him to his ruin. Says Bucer, Othello in the modern drama, Oedipus in the ancient, are the two most conspicuous examples of ruin brought by characters, noble indeed, but not without defects, acting in the dark and as it seemed for the best. The another subheading in this chapter is His Eminence. Aristotle lays down another qualification for the tragic hero. He must be of the number of those in the enjoyment of great reputation and prosperity. In other words, he must be a person who occupies a position of lofty eminence in society. He must be a highly placed individual, well reputed. This is so because Greek tragedy, with which alone Aristotle was familiar, was written about a few distinguished royal families. Aristotle, basing his qualification of the tragic hero on what he was familiar with, considers eminence as essential for the tragic hero. But modern drama has demonstrated that the meanest individual can serve as a tragic hero as well as a prince of blood royal, and that tragedies of Sophoclean grandeur can be enacted even in remote country solitudes. However, Aristotle's dictum is quite justified on the principle that higher the state, the greater the fall that follows, or because heavens themselves blaze forth the death of princes, while the death of a beggar passes unnoticed. But it should be remembered that Aristotle nowhere says that the hero should be a king or at least royally descended. As in other matters, so in this respect also, they were the Renaissance critics who distorted Aristotle and made the qualification more rigid and narrow.